John Batchelor. The conflict in the Middle East is on American campuses. To my understanding, it's widespread. Recently, I witnessed a video on my alma mater, Princeton campus, with chanting that was clearly meant to be confrontational and threatening. Chanting that reminded me of the anti-Vietnam War days of 60 years ago. But in this instance, it was put together with suggestions, more than suggestions, directed at Israelis and Jewish persons of the United States, American citizens, who support Israel in its contest with the Hamas killers. Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution has written about the trouble on elite American universities before, and here we come to it again with news events that are not complete, very much shadowy, but anecdotal. So I'm adding the anecdote of witnessing a video made on the Princeton campus in these last days of chanting that I would have heard if I'd been standing there as a threat. Richard, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this, Professor. I had one more instance, anecdotal. At the Cooper Union in New York City, there were students who were wearing kippahs, clearly Jewish students, in the library, and they felt intimidated by a protester group that had come inside and pounded on the door. There's very incomplete information about it, but it suggests that there is an atmosphere of confrontation and anti-Semitism on college campuses that looks to be about Gaza, but is in fact very much about what they say from the mountain to the sea, wiping out Israel. Good evening to you, Professor.
Good evening to you. These are very difficult times.
Very difficult times, and so therefore we need to characterize how we got here. You and I have spoken of Mr. Eisgruber at Princeton University before. You're familiar with him. He was a student of yours. We've also spoken of the decision by the Harvard faculty to go in a new direction, Claudine Gay. There are other university leaders at Columbia, at Yale, who are making their own decisions. What is striking to me, and listening to you these months about the story, years now about cancel culture, is that these same administrators believe that there was no inhibition whatsoever from blasting and condescending and punishing and decrying people who spoke in some fashion that was understood as dissent. And yet when it comes to these threatening gatherings, most of them provocative, they fall into the First Amendment. They fall into the right of assembly. Has something happened at the college campuses? Are they aware of the contradictions here, Professor?
I don't think they care about them. Let me say, I think you cannot understand the current reaction to Gaza unless you understand the total transformation of American universities. Basically, if you go back 30 or 40 years, campuses were generally liberal, by which I mean center-left, but there was a large, say, 25 to 30% conservatives or mainstream Republican on these campuses. What's happening is there's been a complete conquest and takeover, not only by the left, but by the far left. And so if you start looking at university administrations and so forth, and just ask yourself the question, how many conservatives are inside the administration at Princeton or anywhere else, the answer is today probably none. What has happened is as many people have been forced out because of their conservative views. Others have essentially moved very sharply to the left, like Eisgruber himself, in order to make sure that they could retain their positions. So when it comes to trying to figure out how you have an enforcement of a series of neutral rules essential to the system of free speech, it turns out, unfortunately, there's nobody who's neutral in this situation. So if you go back to Princeton, there was this case of Josh Katz was his name, who was railroaded through a trial because they found something that happened 13 years ago and they managed to force him off campus. When I was on a cruise last year, one of the people there had been a professor of classics at Princeton and he had resigned, and I asked him why did he resign. He said you had two choices. Either you could join in with a mob or you could be utterly alone. But he said the graduate students were completely intolerant of anybody and anything that were different. This was not a man of the right who was talking. This was a straight man right down the center, social democrat. And so what you do is you have this constant replacement of people. And so you now get a set of institutions which is utterly unfair utterly incapable of being fair to anybody else. This also affects with respect to Jewish students. So if you look at the percentage of Jewish students at, say, Harvard or Columbia or Penn, it's down sharply. And it's down sharply because of the huge pressures in favor of affirmative action programs, DEI, and so forth. So what happens, you have all the kindling there. And now what you do is you come up with a big match, and the whole thing starts to blow up. And the question is, what should the university do and how should it respond is a kind of an interesting one. The first thing to note is many universities' administrators take the purest line that they're not going to interfere with free speech no matter how offensive we find the words. And that is an accurate statement to First Amendment law if you're a government institution trying to regulate the way things go, but that's not what's happening at this particular point. What they mean is they won't say anything themselves about the way in which conduct ought to be on their own campuses, even though they're certainly entitled to do so. And the so-called Calvin rules and the Calvin report on free speech makes it very explicit that universities to defend their most sacred institutions when they're attacked. So then what happens is they don't say anything. What about the private speech that you have? Well, there are two things that happen. One is that their Jewish voices tend to be drowned out, and the Palestinian voices become extremely loud. They use microphones and bullhorns and all sorts of other things to disrupt what's going on. And so there's a whole series of rules about time, place, and manner, getting permits to run demonstrations and so forth. The Israeli and Jewish students have tried scrupulously to comply with this, and then even at the University of Chicago, the bullhorns come along, the threats tend out to be made, and the administration sends somebody in Palestinian guard there to be called neutral with respect to what's going on. I mean, there's just a lot of things like that happening. And so it turns out that the so-called neutral arbiter, given the way in which these faculties are constructed, is not neutral at all, which means that one side gets the run of the mill and everybody else has to cower in fear as they did with respect to Cooper Union. And it just seems to be no pushback. Generally speaking, whoever believes in freedom of speech also believes that if somebody else is speaking, you can't shout them down, particularly when they have a permit and you do not. But these rules seem to count for nothing today. And so what you do is you have one group which is completely unregulated, and another group which is in great fear, and there's very little that can happen. What has to happen, and the only thing that's going to happen to stop this, is going to be alumni pressure. At Princeton, I know more people from Penn than I do from Princeton, and there's a larger Jewish population there, and what they're doing is they're giving $1 a year to Princeton because they want to make sure that it's not an oversight when they don't contribute. They want to make sure what their deep resentments turn out to be. And it's the alumni pressure, which is the only thing that is going to work on this situation. And even that is, you know, a chance. These have large endowments, and they may be able to survive it. They may get money from other sources to offset these losses. But I've never seen a situation which is such cowardice on the part of university presidents and such militance on the part of the various Arab and Palestinian students, with the Jewish students cowering in fear. I mean, this is really scary to somebody, and you hear it all the time of what's going on. People are just very, very uneasy. And, you know, we gather all sorts of meetings ourselves and sing Hot Tipper and do lots of things like that to try to boost morale. But what happens is, we know if you go out into the world today, it may not be a safe place. And what one fears, and I think if everybody fears, is it starts like this. There's probably going to be an invasion of some sort with respect to Gaza Strip. And that what you now hear is loud yells and screams is going to turn into some actual violence against certain other people, mainly Jewish people and their supporters. So the world, in fact, has crumbled. I mean, most of us, for example, appreciate what Joe Biden has done in order to basically bolster the force of Israel in the Middle East by sending a carrier, the Gerald Ford, there to, by and large, try to keep the Iranians at bay. Not clear that it's going to work, but that's what he's trying. And so if that call that goes up in one way or another, you can assume that everything on campus is going to intensify, and God knows what will happen.
I want to highlight two words that have come up in these demonstrations, these threatening demonstrations, and you mentioned them in your most recent article about Gaza defining ideas. One word is apartheid, but the new one, to me, completely, is colonialist, settler colonialism. That looks to be coded language. How are they using it, Professor? What is to be done?
Well, the theory of colonialism is the theory that there are alien units that are being injected into the Middle East that don't belong there, and that they took this thing over. Now, it's very strange. Usually when you talk about colonialism, you have some Western power and so forth that takes over and dictates the area. The crazy history of the Middle East was not that. There's never been a nation of Palestine. What happened is the Ottoman Empire controlled it until the end of World War I, at which point the British mandate took over, and it was very unhappy because of the immense pressures between the Arabs and the Jews, and these pressures and difficulties long antedated the massive effort of the Jews to get into Palestine at the end of World War II. So there's a major slaughter that took place in Hebron in 1929. On the other hand, there were events like the opening of the Hebrew University in 1925 on Mount Scopus, which had Arab attendees joining in the particular place. So it's a very mixed kind of history. What happens is you quickly understand when there's this kind of antipathy and the constant danger of danger of force, what you have to do is to believe in partition. And they did have a very ragged map for partition, which did change the area now called Palestine into two states. The Jews accepted it with very bad boundaries, and six Arab armies, literally the day after this was announced, marched in and tried to destroy the Israeli state. And much to everybody's amazement, not only did Israel hold its own, but by the time you had the 1949 armistice, it was basically a larger and slightly more coherent nature than it had been before. It was also admitted shortly thereafter into the United Nations. So you would have thought this issue was settled one way or another. But the definition essentially of a colonialist is a Jew. There's nothing else. Many of the people who live in Israel today were driven out of Arab lands. The remedy that they have is if we take this back, you can go back to Iraq or to Iran or to Morocco and get slaughtered by forces that are hostile to you. So the colonialism is a trope that's trying to literally completely distort the very complicated history that had in that period. And to make it very clear, when you talk about from the river to the sea, this is not a request for a two-state solution. That would be delusional on their part. They want it all. And every time you look on the map and you see it on the wall in Palestinian organization, it covers everything in current Israel and the West Bank. Ironically, Gaza was not part of Palestine. It was a province of Egypt until 1967, when the Arabs from that area invaded Israel and they went back and occupied it to neutralize it. The Egyptians regard Gaza as a huge liability. It left to the Israelis to run it. They made every effort to try and make various kinds of accommodations. But when somebody decides that they're going to import all sorts of arms and weapons and rockets and dig deep kind of tunnels and engage in intense Jew hatred indoctrination in their school system and so forth, you can't sort of let them open the borders and mass whatever weaponry they want there. This is not a prison. What happened in this particular case, it's a blockade, perfectly legal under international law. And when the Israelis made efforts as they did to try and create economic connections between Gaza and Israel itself, essentially these were used by Hamas as a foil to conceal the fact that they were attacking in a war. It's not a pretty picture.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution commenting on what we know now, anecdotally, of the college and university campuses in America under the sway, in some fashion, of people who are practicing threats to Jewish students and Jewish citizens. We're going to turn to the law next, force majeure in Israel, and from the Wall Street Journal. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.